Welcome to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them. I'm John DeSavino, and I'll be your host. This week, we celebrate Pennsylvania author Doug Brown. Doug's stories have appeared in Half and One and Bar Bar. His debut collection, My Bohemian Baptism and Then Some, was recently published by Serif Press. Today, I'll be reading the title story from the collection, but first, we're going to let you hear my interview with Doug, which took place on January 31st of this year. I'd like to welcome Doug Brown to the podcast. How are you doing today, Doug?
I'm doing well, Jim. How are you doing today?
Good. Happy to see you again. We learned in our first conversation that we share some things in common, one of them being our alma mater, Carnegie Mellon University. I know there's debate about, Carnegie or Carnegie? But in Pittsburgh, it's always Carnegie, right?
That's right. That's right. No debate here.
No. Okay, good. So why don't we start out by having you tell us a little bit about your beginnings, you know, where you grew up and what you studied at Carnegie Mellon, just to get a little bit of an idea of where these impulses to write might have stemmed from.
Okay. Well, I was born in Englewood, New Jersey. My father was an electrical engineer working on government contracts. And when I was about 1 year old, we went over to Germany for a 3 or 4 year contract. So I was raised in my early years thinking I was German, learning German as much as English. And then at the end of that period, we came back across the Atlantic on an ocean liner. And, you know, everyone on the ship got up to the rail and watched as we saw the Statue of Liberty come into view. And then when we got off the boat at the seaport in New York, I think it was our aunt and uncle from New Jersey met us. And then they drove us back to their house where we stayed for a short period. You know, I don't remember exactly how long it was. The one thing I do remember is in that car ride, I was given the news that I would now have to speak English all the time. And I remember young, ich bin ein Deutscher Junge, I'm a German boy. And I did not want to speak English. But of course, 2 days later, I'd gotten all about it and I was completely assimilated as far as I know. From there, we spent about a year in New Jersey. Then we moved up to Connecticut for about a year. And then my father took a job in Western Massachusetts around Amherst, where I grew up, as I like to say, as a feral youth for about 12 years until I went off to college. In the days when you cut the door and, you know, as soon as the sun was up and come back when the sun was coming down and basically do whatever you wanted to do and no one was worried about it, no one really cared that much. There were always adults in the neighborhood kind of overseeing everybody and they all talked to each other. So everybody knew where you were, but no one was worried. So, you know, we could ride our bikes through the trails, through the woods and everything. And we had no concern for all of the dark stories of things that happened to kids that do those kind of things. After growing up in Western Mass, then I went out to Pennsylvania to go to school. I went to Penn State for 4 years there. And when I realized I would be miserable if I stayed with anything related to chemistry, I became an English major. But then when I graduated from there, I was planning to go into publishing. I was ready to go to Boston University BA program, and Carnegie Mellon called me up and offered me a scholarship for their new public policy school, now called the Hines School. And after talking through what the differences would be and what I would learn and what I'd be able to do with that kind of degree, I decided that would be a good place for me to learn what I needed to learn next. So I actually got my degree in public policy and management and learned a lot about everything that was happening with computers in the early 80s and all of those kinds of things, in addition to basic management skills, honest management and financial analysis and those kinds of things. And from there, intending to go into publishing, I ended up in catalog marketing, which was a lot of fun for about 25 years until catalogs were not the greatest thing anymore. And from there, I ended up going into internet marketing, which is a little different world, but it's, you know, still a lot of the same things. A lot of the same skills are required, a lot of the same sensibilities.
You're now living in Pennsylvania, in Western Pennsylvania, correct?
That's correct. I met my wife in Pittsburgh. She grew up in Pittsburgh, so we have all of those connections. After graduating and working for about 8 or 9 years in Pittsburgh, I took a few other jobs that took us around the country still. I took a job in New York for a couple of years, and then I went to Providence, and then we went up to New Hampshire, where we spent a total of about 11 years with a 5-year stay down in Florida. So all told, it was kind of a big circle that brought us finally back to Pennsylvania, but those were the steps it took, and it was a lot of fun.
And we're going to be talking about your new collection, which is actually your debut collection, My Bohemian Baptism, that you were kind enough to send me a copy of. And I noticed that many of those stories in the collection are set in New England towns, often small towns, New Hampshire, I noticed Rhode Island, the places that you mentioned, Connecticut. So you obviously still have some fondness for the years that you lived in those areas.
Yeah, I do. And I think New England has a kind of a unique quaintness in that there is so much that can be unique in any given situation. And yet there's so much that's accessible. You can be at the seashore, you can be in the mountains, you can be in a mountain lake, you could be in a city. It's awfully convenient for the sake of story. What I love about New England is that there are so many different ways of talking, different ways of acting, and they're all so close. And so I find New England to be a very comfortable thing to write about and to be able to work with.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier the childhood you had. You called it a feral adolescence or child, where you could like ride your bike, yep, you know, past sunset, and you could be out there on your own and no one would have any concern about your welfare. And I grew up, I'm a bit older than you, but still, we both grew up in those times, late 60s, early 70s, when the world was a very different place. And, you know, the freedom that a child had, when I think of the kind of freedoms that we had, just those kinds of freedoms, I pick up on the nostalgia that you have for those kinds of feelings too in these stories. And I want to talk about that because these stories really did speak to me. And that's another thing that we both have in common. I grew up in Massachusetts, so I know exactly the qualities that you're speaking about, you know, when you talk about these towns and these states and how much they afford a young person, a child growing up. And, you know, I have to say I had a wonderful childhood, and I can't imagine growing up too many other places, honestly. So let's get into the stories. I really loved this collection. I enjoyed reading it so much.
I really appreciate that.
Oh, well, this is the joy for me of doing this podcast. And I'm just so glad that circumstances have brought us together in this way so that I can share your work with the listeners of this podcast. Because, you know, I really think this book is terrific. And there's a real variety of types of stories in the collection. But, you know, getting back to what we were just talking about, a number of these are first person narratives written from a young man's point of view, a boy's point of view. You know, they're coming of age stories, rite of passage stories, and the title story, My Bohemian Baptism, happens to be one of these as well. So let's start off with that story, talking about My Bohemian Baptism, which is set in the summer of 1975, which I remember well. And it's a story of a boy who is farmed off to some relatives, an aunt and uncle in Connecticut, because his mom is going through chemo and his dad is serving time in a white collar prison for some kind of tax fraud, tax evasion. We don't know for sure. So, you know, while his mother is undergoing the chemo treatment, he's been sent off to stay with this aunt and uncle who happen to be a couple of hippies who, you know, live in this kind of ramshackle place, very eccentric characters. You know, they have a coffee table where the boy finds among the magazines, not only Mother Jones, but also Playboy magazine. It is definitely, you know, a rite of passage kind of story. And, you know, the boy, he becomes infatuated with his aunt and uncle's daughter, who happens to be a teenager named Chrissy. There is a plot to this story, and there is a tragedy that takes place in the story. You know, I just want to talk about the mood, the atmosphere for this story. It feels like there may be some lived experience behind the creation of the story. Could you speak to that?
Well, I don't know if there's as much real life experience as you're hoping to hear about, but
okay.
The real life experience, where the story really came from, was that I actually had a friend in school whose parents were both teachers. His mother was an English teacher at our high school, and his father taught English at the next town over. And we rode the same bus route when we were in elementary school. And his stop was one where they would meet us at the end of what was about a mile-long dirt road that went back to where their house was, but the bus would not go down that road. Mm. So that was kind of the start of the idea. But the I think the mood of it is just about how in the mid 70s we were, you know, we were definitely past what was really the hippie kind of phase where people were hippies for good reasons. And the people that were still hippies were kind of hangers on, mostly for marijuana purposes. That's kind of where my mind was when I was thinking about this, you know, how some of the ideals had fallen away. You know, we were kind of headed toward disco and punk, but we weren't there yet. It was a time that was looking for something to believe in, and we were about to celebrate the bicentennial. And, you know, I think there was some concern about whether that was the right thing to be celebrating or whether were we going to be on to something else. So I think it was just all a very confusing time. And that was really the backdrop for the story. But I remembered a lot of things distinctly about their house because I had gone and spent a good amount of time with my friends, especially as we grew up and became teenagers and everything. And especially as teenagers, their house was one of the favorites for us to hang out at because of the tendencies of his parents. So they tended to allow a lot of things that we were interested in trying out. But that's really what was behind the story and kind of where it came from and where it was going. And from there, the story just kind of takes on its own direction.
The central character, the narrator, it's such a sympathetic character, certainly if you've lived during those years and, you know, we're of a similar age, you can really relate to the experiences that this kid is having, living in this strange but kind of wonderful place in some ways. You know, the yeah. Uncle Bert is perpetually stoned and always, you know, sneaking off out back to smoke, and his naivete is very sweet. And you are able to work a love story into this. I mean, it's like unrequited love, but, you know, yeah. I love puppy love, kind of unrequited love stories where, like, this character becomes infatuated with his cousin, Chrissy, who's taken an interest in him and yeah. you know, plays games with him and does stuff with him. But then he sees, you know, how the adult world starts to relate to her, being, you know, an attractive adolescent. And that kind of changes his worldview. And that's where the story kind of pivots when that begins to happen. You know, you really do capture the kind of disillusionment with the ideals of the 60s. You really capture that beautifully with these characters of Aunt Velma and Uncle Bert. And as far as the title of the collection goes, did you have a particular reason why you chose to use this story's title as the title for the whole collection?
Well, on the one hand, I tend to use very short titles, which I think is actually a weakness. And it was one of the most descriptive titles and one that I felt kind of hinted at the overall tendency that I have in writing to kind of present something and then try to find where the twist comes in so that what you're expecting to hear about a baptism is suddenly not a baptism.
Yeah. And I should say that the full title of the book is My Bohemian Baptism and Then Some. There is a little coda at the end there just to yeah. indicate that there's more than this one particular transition that will be represented in these stories. But yeah, I think it's a really appropriate title, given the nature of many of these stories being narratives from a young person's point of view and often being coming of age kind of stories. So while we're on that subject, I'd like to ask you about writing from a child's point of view. Is this a voice that you gravitate to because it feels comfortable to you?
I think one of the things that I gravitate toward is generally a longer term view of time, so that there tend to be a lot of opportunities for flashbacks or revisiting situations that aren't necessarily present. And the other thing that I think is central to that is that this collection in particular, really when I started writing about 2 years ago, you know, picking it up from 30 some years past, I did it partly as therapy. And in therapy, I mean that in my writing process, there's a systematic way of looking at it, that if something is coming back to my mind over and over again, if something is occupying space, that needs to be dealt with. And this is a way I had of dealing with that. So I think the logical progression will be that the more I write, the less childhood experiences that I'll be writing about, and the more later life experiences I'll end up writing about. But I still expect that I'll have this kind of longer term view of time where a person that I'm talking to today actually represents a host of experiences that they've had over the years, and some that we could go back to and reference what's going on today.
Hmm. Time comes up as a concept in these stories. Your background, you said that you studied chemistry initially, right?
Yeah, I started off in science and chemistry and then moved on to English and business.
Mm. Wow, that's quite a leap. And now you're writing stories. You had told me that you stopped writing stories in high school and only really resumed writing stories like decades later. How many years would you say it was between the time that you remember having written the last story in high school, say, and when you began writing again later in your adult life?
Well, one correction is that I stopped writing when I got out of undergrad.
Okay.
So from undergrad to today is, I want to say 38 years. Is it 38?
Hmm.
38 years. And what happened is I got out of undergrad. I said, okay, I'm going on to the grad school, because that was the discussion in my house, you know, that, well, if you're going to major in English, you're going to get a graduate degree. I said, okay, I'm fine with that, but you don't have to push me to that. But when I got out of undergrad, you know, I had this feeling that I wanted to write. I had more to write, but I knew that if I only wrote based on my experience at that point, I would be writing a bunch of adolescent stories. And that wasn't what I wanted to end up doing in terms of writing. So I said to myself, well, I have to a little bit and then have something to write about. And from there, I got married and had kids, and that took on a life of its own, as it so often does. And that's really the conscious decisions involved. And that just happened to be, you know, 38 years later.
What did that feel like when you started to write again after all those years? Getting going, was that a difficult process, or was it easier because of that?
I think it was easy. In the dedication, one of the people I included was a Mrs. P, and she's a mother of a friend of mine. And I included her because when I ran into her a little before I started picking up writing again, I hadn't seen her for about 35 years. And she said, oh, I remember you. You were the young man that wanted to write stories. And it was just like a veil was lifted from my eyes, because that coincided really with kind of empty nesting and everything and having time available suddenly to do things I used to like to do. And that was something that just reminded me, that is what I like to do. I'm going to go back and do that. So that's why Mrs. P is included in the dedication.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And so having begun again to write stories, it sounds like you've kind of found your way back to a calling that was a big part of you. It's just something that you had to kind of leave behind, like, you know, the dream deferred kind of thing. So I imagine putting this book out must have felt very good.
it did. It really did.
So, yeah. And I do want to talk about the process, you know, that you went through to get the book published. And maybe we'll end with that. But, you know, I kind of veered off course there. We were talking about your knowledge of the sciences. You clearly have a very deep, in some cases, it feels like encyclopedic knowledge of the sciences, math and physics. You do go into some theoretical stuff in these stories. Yeah, let's just talk about that. There's a story in here, which I would have to call a speculative fiction story. Actually, you know, there are a couple that kind of skirt around the speculative, but this one I would say is definitely a speculative story. And that is the one with the title, I don't even know how I'm going to say this. It's a sound that you've,
yes,
that you've spelled with P-H-H-H-H-T, I think, is that it?
Yeah. Yeah. I've never actually pronounced it out loud. It's basically the sound that young boys used to make with their hand under their armpit.
With their, yes. The old hand under the armpit sound, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's one of the key things that I look for, is always an opportunity to push beyond what anybody else can get away with.
Mm.
But yeah, having a title that no one wants to pronounce, I think, is kind of an interesting place to be.
Well, certainly, you know, an attention getter. And yet it does happen to be an important part of the story because there is a scientific reason for this sound that's made when people travel through time in the way the main character in the story is trying to explain it to a board of directors for the company that he works for, a company that is venturing into this service, which is offering time travel to travelers. It's very funny, the story. And, you know, I mean, it's clearly meant to be satirical, and it does poke fun at the corporate world. But the product that they're working on creating is a time travel product called the Timeplex Suite, which is going to offer a tiers of service based on membership levels, from like an entry level to a premium level, going up to what is the very top, Timeplex Black, which is going to just be for government officials. And this is where it gets a little frightening, you know, when we realize what this might lead to in the hands of government officials.
Right.
But it's a lunchtime meeting, and these executives, all they can think about is the lunch that they're ordering from the local restaurant. And you really, I nailed these characters because I have, you know, worked in the corporate world, and I recognize all of these guys.
Yeah.
That must have been fun to write, because I know that you've worked in the corporate world as well, right? So you probably,
yeah.
These are people
a lot of time in boardrooms.
So I know these are probably composites of people that you've worked for.
That's right. Yeah. I just started thinking about, you know, people have suggested to me, why don't you write a story about time travel? And when they say that, they're thinking of things like Outlander and The Notebook, and, you know, these kind of romantic spins on time travel. And while they're saying that, I'm just thinking, well, what would it actually look like if we came up with the technology to do that? Who would get their hands on it? What would they do? You know, and the first thing is that they'd figure out how to make money off it. So that's what started that whole thing, and the rest of it just fell out.
But you do get into some, you know, kind of technical explanations. That's where the humor comes from, because this poor guy who's been given the responsibility of putting this presentation together, who has this knowledge, is trying to explain to these guys, you know, the science behind this idea. And they just are not getting it. So you're really getting a sense of the guy's frustration and how he keeps, you know, having to kind of dial it back. So are those experiences that you've had in your life where, you know, you've had to kind of explain things on a technical level, and you get that look, the deer in the headlight look?
Yeah. Often it's, well, what does it come down to in terms of dollars, and what are we going to make at the end of the year? And, you know, I'm often in the position of trying to explain where there are other issues we have to figure out along the way. Some of them are ethical, some of them are practical, but usually they don't want to hear about those.
No, right. Right. Because, yeah, I mean, there has to be insurance. One of the fun things that you get into is the fact that waivers need to be signed, because accidents can happen. You know, if someone is sent to a moment, you know, in space and time where that's being occupied by something or someone, that's going to cause all kinds of horrible problems for everybody.
Right.
I laughed a lot during that story. And I have to say that even though there is quite a bit of humor in your stories, that one, given its satirical nature, I could see you having a lot of fun mining the humor in that one. So, and it was a surprise too, because it kind of came out of left field. There really isn't another story in there quite like that one. So when I started to read that, I'm like, wow, all right. he's really decided to go out on a limb here. You know, not that your stories don't take chances. I mean, you do take chances with your stories, but I just love that you took a, you know, total left turn with that story.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to point out, on the cover of your book, you got some really nice blurbs from other writers. And the one at the top and on the back starts, "Doug Brown's stories are weird." This is from Jane Greer, author of Love Like a Conflagration and The World as We Know It is Falling Away. I get what she's saying. I didn't find your stories weird, Doug. You know, there are a few that had me thinking a lot. Like that first story, Census, which is one of the stories that kind of skirts the speculative. It's a bit dystopian about a census taker who visits an old woman and her housebound husband. And it becomes an interrogation. It starts out as a survey, and you realize as this thing goes on that it's more of an interrogation and that the designs of this person are not what you are led to believe that they would be at first. So,
right.
So yeah, why don't we talk about that story? Because that is full of surprises.
It's funny you should pick up on that one, because that was a story I wrote when I was working on a story that was giving me too many problems. And I put the other story down and I wrote Census in something like 4 hours. So I can't explain as much about it because it just came out.
Mm. There is a plot in this of sorts, right?
Yep.
And yep. It does have kind of a stinger ending. So, you know, maybe talk about the process while writing the story of, did you just kind of arrive at that ending, or was that something that you had to work out? Because endings are so important from what every writer tells me, finding the perfect way to end a story. Did you kind of know how the story was going to end as you were writing it, or did you have to kind of work that out as you went?
Well, I had the general sense that, starting with the premise that everybody has an agenda and every agenda decides how to use words in their own way, so that you can no longer trust the meaning of words anymore.
Mm.
So based on that, you throw together some people that all mean well, and somebody that's been tasked by a larger entity to do what appears to be a simple job, where they've spelled out everything to do, and then they send them out into the world. And from there, you just see what havoc they can wreak. So I had that much of an idea of where it was going to go. I wasn't sure how it would end. And the particular ending that it ended with, I was kind of discounting that as, no, that's where people would expect it to end.
Mm.
But then when I actually worked through it, it was the ending it was calling for. So I surrendered to the story.
All right. Well, that's, surrendered to the story. I love that. But what's so fun about this story is that it really takes a while for the reader to figure out that there's something quite off. You throw in little teasers slowly over the course of the story. It sounds perfectly legit. And then it's like, she says something, the census taker, this is a young woman who happens to know the old woman who she's there to ask these questions of. But little by little, the things that come out of this census taker's mouth start to make you go, what the heck? This cannot be an actual census. And then when it starts to get deep into a very specific kind of political agenda, then the eyebrows go up and you go, oh, okay, all right, this is, right. We're on a whole different track here.
So
that was a lot of fun. And, your stories are fun, I have to say. Not that they don't tackle some serious issues or talk about hardships in people's lives. But there are a couple of stories here that are not really mysteries. I'm talking about Ruskin's Mulch and Not Convenient, which have elements of mystery in them. And yet they're not your conventional mystery by any means. Let's end talking about Not Convenient, because I thought that was such a tremendous story. That title, Not Convenient, made me think of Bartleby the Scrivener, which is a Herman Melville story most of us, read in high school, or at least know of, where the title character has a catchphrase where he says, I prefer not to. And in this case, the main character, Lionel, his catchphrase is, this is not convenient for me. Did Bartleby the Scrivener spring to mind at any point during the writing of this?
No, not directly.
Okay.
It was probably the most directly spurred on by some of my business experience.
Mm.
There was a time when I was no longer in catalog marketing and kind of navigating what to do next. And that situation was where the story begins, where I was trying some different things and working with different people. And, I said, well, this one character I work with is a perfect character, and he is the boss at the beginning. And at some point, I spent a couple of years working with him. And finally, I said, this is not working for me. This is not paying my bills. This is not becoming a career. I'm looking for other things. So that was kind of the genesis of the opening scene, where the partner character is saying, well, we're going on with business along these lines. And, you know, Lionel is simply saying, well, what you say going on with business does not translate into any business for me. There's no income coming out of it for me. So, you know, he was in that situation of saying, okay, what is next?
And then Lionel gets the opportunity just by chance. His uncle passes away, leaving the estate to the father. But it turns out in the course of the story, Lionel finds out that his father has suffered a stroke and is not in any condition to be able to be an executor of someone's estate. So it gets signed over to Lionel then as a power of attorney. And then this begins this very interesting journey that Lionel goes on, where he finds out more about this uncle who owns, or now it's turned over to his family, but he owned a summer campgrounds and sundry other businesses that Lionel finds out about as he's going through all the papers and trying to figure out just exactly, you know, what this all adds up to. And underneath all of that, there is a story of the hush money being paid to the uncle. He discovers these envelopes full of cash and realizes that this uncle is being paid hush money by these like small-time local mobsters who happen to be neighbors by the campsite, a restaurant, this Italian family who attempted a murder, which went bad. And there was video from the security footage. And I mean, it just turns into this really wonderful character study. You have all these wonderful characters. Let's just talk about writing characters, because this was a story where the characters really stood out. And you actually, sometimes you were using dialect and writing their dialogue. So talk about the process of how you figured out what was going to work best in the writing of that story.
Well, I already alluded to the idea that when something is sticking in my mind, I realize that it has to be dealt with, and then I decide to write about it. But when something sticks in my mind, it doesn't necessarily mean it's ready to be a story. So, and usually I'll do kind of like background passages and put them aside as kind of like file passages. And if I like what's in it, I might turn it into an outline. But if a character emerges and that character stays with me, like when I close my eyes at night, they start to talk to me. I know that is a story. So they have a story if they're starting to talk to me. And those were the kind of characters that were in that story. And you had mentioned Ruskin's Mulch. That was the one that I put aside to write Census and then came back to, because in both Ruskin's Mulch and Not Convenient, they both had characters that were lurking, that were presenting themselves, that were repeating these scenes. And I had to do something with them to basically free them from the purgatory of repeating these scenes over and over again. But that's basically how I work. When something is recurring enough in my mind that I can start to hear how they're talking to me and see the things that they're doing and know what they're going to do next, then we have a story to write.
Yes. And you know, you mentioned Ruskin's Mulch. The characters in that story are very vivid and wonderful as well. And, you know, there's this underworld element in that story as well. You don't have them take up a lot of space. They're kind of on the periphery, which I love, you know, but they're there. Yeah. And they add so much color to the story.
Yeah.
And Ruskin's Mulch, I just have to say, you know, what that story is about. Ruskin is the landscape contractor for some wealthy people in Connecticut, or maybe it's Rhode Island in this case. He ends up getting convicted of murder, and it turns out that he's put the bodies in a mulcher, and that's how he's disposed of the bodies. So now there's human matter on the properties of all these people who he worked for as a landscaper. That's just a hilarious premise. And the story, you know, bears that out in hilarious ways. So the book is just full of all kinds of fun characters and surprising twists and turns. And it was a real delight to read. Before we end, and we are running out of time here, I want to just talk a little bit about Serif Press and the experience of having this published. Is it something that was a long and arduous process? How did you go about getting this to Serif Press?
Well, Serif Press was a connection through a circle of friends I had put down writing, you know, decades ago, but my friend circle still contained a lot of writers doing a range of different things, from ghostwriting to editing poetry journals to, you know, a lot of different literary pursuits. And a friend of a friend is the main person behind Serif Press. So when I felt like I was headed toward a collection, I sat down and had lunch with one friend of mine, and I said, so where should I be looking? What is the market for short story collections? And, you know, he basically said, well, there's not really a market for short stories at this point. And I know you can argue that point a little bit, but it's true that it's not something that's readily monetized in a lot of ways that are easy to point to. But he said, well, we have our friend who, and this fellow I knew was involved in a lot of translation work and a lot of very scholarly kinds of writing. I knew he did professionally, but he said, well, he has a publishing imprint, and he's publishing Sam Hazo. He's publishing, you know, a bunch of other things, and he's published a couple of my things. So you should go there first. He'd probably be very open to it. And approached him. And if you go to the Serif Press website, you see they do have a lot of things that are more along the scholarly lines, and they have kind of this Catholic publication angle. But I approached him and I said, would you be interested in a more general appeal collection of short stories? And he said, well, your short stories are exactly the kind of thing we're looking for. So it was, from my point of view, very easy. This was a case where that particular press was kind of open to a new direction, and I was that new direction for them.
Well, that was serendipitous. Being in the right place at the right time really paid off.
Right. Saved me a lot of work with sending more submissions out and waiting for responses after 6 months and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of people listening to this are going to be very jealous, Doug, when they hear that story. But it's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful edition. It's got a great cover. You know, it's very handsomely packaged. I hope it does really well. It's available on, I would imagine, the typical venues, Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Is there a digital edition of this yet?
Not yet. From my point of view, I was kind of thinking, well, I'll get the first collection out just for the publication credit. And for that, I'll get the second collection out in another year or so, and then start worrying about things like electronic editions.
In the meantime, I hope you continue to keep turning out these wonderful stories. This has been enormous fun. Thank you so much for joining me today, Doug. I know you work a day job, so I appreciate you taking the time out to do this with me today.
Well, thank you, John. And that means a lot to me. And I also just want to say how important I think what it is that you're doing with Short Story Today. It's like you're a jeweler with a stone, and each stroke is revealing another facet. And when you step back and look at your handiwork, you see all of this wonderful short story creativity that's out there.
I just get so much pleasure from doing it, and I get to meet wonderful people like you. So for me, I'm just having a blast in my, you know, retirement year. So thank you for helping me on my journey.
Thank you.
And now we'll move on to the short story. Today I'll be reading My Bohemian Baptism, the title story from Doug's collection. So here it is, My Bohemian Baptism by Doug Brown. Could it be that the epilogue to the book of Job was added by some young editor who couldn't let go of the idea that God need only push us so far? Let's just add another 11 verses to wrap it up neatly and put a bow on it. In my case, those 11 verses took 30 years. I parked my car where the pavement ended and got out to walk the better part of a mile to the house where I had spent the summer 30 years earlier, the town of Canaan, in the northwest corner of Connecticut between Sharon and Goshen, enjoyed a short-lived mining boom in its distant past, but the town has since reverted to its feral state. It's the kind of quiet hole in the wall once sought out by hippies and anyone trying to avoid the notice of the man. That's where my Aunt Velma and Uncle Bert lived, being the well-worn hippies that they were. In my father's words, their place was a Berkshire bayou at the end of a road just long enough to lead nowhere good. Depot Road was less a road and more an accumulation of loose gravel and parallel ruts running from a rusty street sign. Its reason for being was the salt depot,
a timber-framed shed that can be seen in photographs dating back to the 1880s. It housed a 6-foot pile of something we assumed to be road salt. No one seemed to know why the road salt was there. No town vehicles ever came by to add to or subtract from that pile, though town workers occasionally stopped by and entered the shed through the side door. The barn-style side-by-side garage doors on the front remained locked with a padlock and a patina that spoke of the Ancient of Days. The gravel road passed a good-sized spring-fed fishing hole, and from it flowed a pleasant stream that was the perfect size for crossing with the aid of one or two well-placed stepping stones. From where the gravel road petered out, another 70 or 80 feet of dirt road served as a driveway leading to my aunt and uncle's house. Now as then, the road and the surrounding woods formed a haphazard patchwork that mostly obscured the empty, neglected house from view. But as I drew closer to the house, it presented a facade of accidental patches and sad repairs, where in 1975 it had more of an atmosphere of optimistic, eclectic intention, bohemian charm. It all seemed as I remembered it, except diminished and faded with the passing years. Back in the summer of 75, I was a coin flipped by a thumb, caught by a hand, slapped down on a forearm. My sister says I barely spoke that whole year. By the end of June, my father was serving his 6th month of a 9-month sentence in a white-collar minimum security prison for tax irregularities, and my mother was beginning chemo. Chemo in 1975 was the medical community saying, "We don't know what else to do. Let's try killing her slowly and see if the cancer will pack up and leave before she does." My sister was 15, old enough to be a help to my mother and allow her to stay as long as possible in the house. I was 6, a burden and a bother. My sister Patty had her learner's permit, and my mother allowed her to drive the station wagon out to Auntie Velma and Uncle Bert's place. The drive was an hour and a half, so when we arrived, they planned to spend some time to recharge before my mother and sister would turn around and head home again, without me. Patty pulled the car up as close as possible behind Uncle Bert and Aunt Velma's faded sea-blue VW microbus, so my mother wouldn't have to walk farther than necessary. Patty placed my suitcase on the porch and then helped my mother up the steps and in the door. Aunt Velma was a younger image of my mother, except for an unruly mane of black hair. She helped my mother to a seat at the kitchen table, where she had fresh-baked cinnamon rolls and a pot of flavored coffee waiting for her. Flavored coffee was big in 1975, and Aunt Velma was very big on learning how to do things like flavoring coffee. "I used dandelion and mint, grown right out here," she said, pointing to the chaos beyond her 3-season porch. I stood silently at my mother's side, with my hand ineffectually on her shoulder, as she repeatedly lifted the cup to her mouth, but barely touched the liquid to her lips. My 16-year-old cousin Chrissy came halfway down the stairs and waved, calling out, "Hi, Auntie!" and then gestured to my sister, "Patty, come on up to my room." At that point, Patty rushed up the stairs and disappeared for the duration of their visit. Uncle Bert walked into the kitchen to pay his respects. "Good to see you, Peg. I hope your treatment goes well." An awkward silence filled the room, as if he had said, "Great weather for a hanging." In 1975, no one said the word cancer. It was the C word, the big C, and to say it out loud was a jinx. Uncle Bert looked at me and said, "Admiral Nelson, why don't you come see what I have in the living room?" He ushered me out of the kitchen. I quickly realized he had nothing in particular to show me in the living room. This first moment of disorientation would not be my last. "First of all, we drop all that pretension of titles," Bert said, steering me with one hand on the back of my head. "You can call us Bert and Velma, just like Chrissy does." This was the pattern with Bert. He would issue rules as if he were granting new freedoms. And I knew Bert had distaste for my given name, Nelson. I can remember him badgering my father, saying, "What do you call a boy named Nelson? Nelly? Nell? It's like a freaking girl's name." Uncle Bert tended to make me uncomfortable. My father would say, "He's not well-spoken, especially for a schoolteacher." He was known for getting into loud arguments at family cookouts. My father had banned him from our house in Darien at one point early in Bert and Velma's marriage. He claimed that Bert had disrespected our Aunt Claire, my father's older unmarried sister. He may even have pushed her into the pool. His defense had been that he was just fooling around. It seemed he was always just fooling around. Bert sat down on the sofa and patted the cushion next to him. I sat. "So, Nelson, heard from your dad lately?" He stared at me. "Not surprised. Once a dipwad, always a dipwad." He peered at me over his glasses. Bert was not like most of the characters in my parents' world. He was 40-ish, but he had a ponytail and looked like Ben Franklin in his round, wire-frame glasses. He wore sandals and suit vests without suits. He smoked, but never bought cigarettes. He got sloppy drunk, but he acted sloppy sometimes when he hadn't been drinking. He would repeat things my father said, just changing the accent. "You would say that. You would say that. You would say that. You would say that." He always seemed argumentative around my father, although he never really argued with him, since the day of the incident by our pool. He looked over at me intently. "Did they tell you where he went? Or why?"
"He's at the country club."
I fidgeted in my seat. I pushed my hands under my thighs. "He's making friends and playing chess and basketball." "And why did they send him away to play chess and basketball?" He looked at me without smiling. He answered his own question. "Because he committed unspeakable crimes against the working man, robbing him of the fruits of his labor. But I promised Velma I wouldn't go into that. So just file that away for later, kid." He seemed to talk a lot about this working man, but unless he worked for the town of Canaan, I never caught sight of him. And Bert certainly didn't spend a lot of time working, as far as I could see. I sat swinging my legs, not sure how to respond to any of this, staring at my keds. Beyond the arc of my feet was the bottom shelf of the well-worn coffee table with a stash of magazines. I could make out Playboy and Mother Jones. Bert followed my eyes. "You like to look at tatas and yayas?" "Maybe not yet, huh?" He reached across to a stack of materials on the coffee table. He picked up a TV remote and a magazine printed on newsprint. He pointed the remote across the room. "Okay, there's the TV." He pointed to a 20-inch Zenith on a rolling stand with a set of rabbit ears on top. He held up the remote. "Here's the remote." He held up the newsprint magazine. "Here's the program guide. We don't subscribe to the fancy TV guide like at your house. We use this." He gave the magazine a light shake. "It comes in the Sunday paper for free." He looked down at me. "And while I'm at it, here are the rules around here. Velma maybe makes one meal a day. Maybe. Otherwise, if you're hungry, you fend for yourself. Help yourself. Don't waste food. Don't leave food out. A raccoon might come in a window and steal it." He stared at me. "Or a bear." His eyes got wider. "Or a dragon." I still had no idea how to respond. He continued, "Worst case, ask, and Velma or Chrissy or I might feel sorry for you and make you something. No one has arbitrary roles based on their physical attributes." He leaned down toward me. "And if people are listening to music, grooving or otherwise intent on self-actualization, let it go. It's okay. We're not uptight like at your house, where you have different clothes for every frickin' meal and every frickin' day of the week, and go around walking on eggshells, afraid to hurt anybody's feelings or step out of line. Well, you'll get it. You'll adjust. You'll unwind a little in a day or 10, and you'll probably be here the whole summer. Well, depending on how your mom does." "What?" "Never mind. Forget I mentioned it." He got up and retrieved a worn acoustic guitar from the corner. "You know this one?" He strummed, made some adjustments, and began finger-picking his accompaniment. "John Henry was about 3 days old, sitting on his pappy's knee. He picked up a hammer and a little piece of steel, said, 'Hammer's gonna be the death of me, Lord. Lord, hammer's gonna be the death of me.'" After Mom and Patty left, Bert wandered into the kitchen and spoke in a low tone. "So she give you some scratch?" Velma said tearily, "Is that all you can think about?" She stood up and pulled a small wad out of her jeans pocket. "Here, don't spend it all." She wiped her eyes with the tissue. "Just gonna get some suds. You want I should pick us up some Chianti? No?" He turned around to head out the front door. Looking back at Velma, he said, "And maybe a little—" and he puckered his lips and made a sucking sound. "Not in front of the kid," Velma cautioned him. "I promised Peg, don't make a liar out of me."
Okay, not in front of the kid.
That afternoon, Chrissy took my suitcase from the porch and carried it up the stairs. I followed along. This will be your room, she said, turning right at the top of the stairs. But when I reached the top of the stairs, my attention was drawn to the left by a doorway full of strings of beads, and beyond that, a series of colorful random scarves and ornaments hanging from the ceiling. That's my room, Chrissy said from across the hall. I stood in the doorway, running my hands back and forth in the beads, and then stepping in and out of the curtain of beads. I was fascinated by the feel and sound of the beads just walking in and out of her doorway. Chrissy's bedroom had windows in the gable end, facing the driveway and the salt shed. The walls on either side rose half-height and then inclined to follow the roof line until they reached the ceiling. Along the side walls, there were several half-height doors that opened to storage spaces in the eaves. I would sleep in the room across the hall, clearly a junk room. It was a mirror image of Chrissy's room with windows facing the opposite direction, toward the stream. Only in this mirror, not only were right and left translated, but also beauty and ugliness, color and monochrome. It contained a wooden desk chair, a small wooden bookcase, piles of books, and a rolling clothes rack standing against the left wall. There was a mattress made up with sheets, blanket, and pillowcases. It sat directly on the floor in the middle of the room beneath an overhead light. Chrissy placed my little suitcase on the chair. The bookcase was filled with books. There were more books piled on top and along each side, like a pirate's chest overflowing with treasure. It looked almost as if the books were endlessly bubbling out of the bookcase, a mysterious cornucopia.
"Captain Courageous," she said. "You want to go dig up some dinner?"
I nodded. I followed Chrissy into the kitchen. Velma sat at the kitchen table staring into her coffee. We filed past the table to the counter adjacent to the refrigerator. Like a young lion or hyena nosing in on a group kill, I edged up to the counter with my nose and fingers resting on the edge, a kid-sized Kilroy. Chrissy placed two pieces of bread on the counter. Then, looking at me, she pulled out two more. Peering into the refrigerator, she asked, "Bologna? It's either ham or bologna." "Bologna? Mustard? Mayo?" "No, just bologna." I nodded for the bologna. Chrissy handed me the sandwich. Velma sat at the table as if caught between two worlds. At times, she sat like a ghost, visible but powerless to change anything in the current time or place. Other times, she interacted with us, though she still seemed burdened, preoccupied with people and events elsewhere. She sat silent and still until we started to move out of the kitchen. Then she looked up, smiled, and asked me, "Do you know the word proceed? P-R-O-C-E-E-D. To go forward, to continue." I nodded. She repeated, "Proceed, P-R-O-C-E-E-D, to go forward, to continue." I repeated after her, "Proceed, P-R-O-C-E-E-D, to go forward, to continue." She smiled.
"Very good."
On my first morning in the house, I threw off the sheets and slid off the mattress to the bare wooden floor and scooted on my haunches over to the bookcase. As I began to assess this treasure trove of volumes, I heard from the hallway a sound of hinges and beads that would become one of my fondest associations of that summer. Looking up toward the door, I saw Chrissy in her pajamas, underwear, really, leaning against the doorframe. She reached in and flicked on the overhead light. "What you doing, little man?" she asked, yawning. "Little big man?" She shuffled over in her fuzzy bunny slippers to where I sat cross-legged. She joined me on the floor. "What you looking at?" My silence continued as I just didn't seem to have words for this strange new world I found myself in. I just remember looking up at Chrissy as she spoke, calmly, gently, like a stream of cool, clean water to my world-weary soul. Reaching her arm out, she waved over the books. "Those? In those boxes? Were mine when I was little. Some of these," she swirled her hand over one distinct pile, "were Velma's textbooks. She brings the old ones back. I don't know why." She shook her head and looked down at me. "Those in the bookcase are mostly Bert's from college or his personal books and stuff." Chrissy then looked at me and said, "Do you want to play a game?" Straightening her arms, she raised herself off the floor without uncrossing her legs and swiveled to face me. "Turn toward me," she gestured.
This is called patty cake, okay? She held her hands out and began to demonstrate. Clap. She put her hands together. One. She took my hand in one of hers and pressed my palm to hers. Two. Now the other hands. Clap. Together again. Cross. This time holding my left to her left. Cross. My right to her right. Got it? She silently ran through the motions. And then we sing, like the grand old Duke of York. He had 10,000 men. He marched them up to the top of the hill, and he marched them back again. And when they're up, they're up. And when they're down, they're down. And when they're only halfway up, they're neither up nor down. Oh! She nodded to me, inviting me to sing and do the hand motions. It then sped up with each round. When the round devolved into laughter and crossed up hands flying between us, she reached over and put her hand on top of my head. Let's go get some breakfast. This was the way the summer went. It was like a tapestry in which Chrissy's thread appeared most frequently. Velma's thread appeared and disappeared, but always in muted colors. Bert's was mostly behind the cloth. For one thing, Bert was teaching summer school. He did earn a little extra money by teaching the 6 weeks of lessons over the course of 7 weeks of the summer. He repeatedly referred to August 10th as Liberation Day, the day he would be done with summer school classes, and then he could enjoy some real time off. Bert was up early on school days. He had a morning bathroom ritual that Velma referred to as coughing up a lung. From her description, I imagined him heaving up the majority of his internal organs every morning and somehow regenerating them by mid-afternoon when he typically returned home from school. I often tried to catch a glimpse of this miraculous event, but I never managed to witness it. When Bert was around, he was eating, drinking, or playing his guitar. After getting home from school, he often spent an hour or so learning or practicing songs that he wanted to use in class. In the summer of 75, he played Puff the Magic Dragon, Big Rock Candy Mountain, and This Land is Your Land. One day, he came home with a record album under his arm, Desire. Bert set up the record player on the front porch and played one song, The Hurricane, over and over again as he tried to learn the music and the lyrics. It was the story of boxer Reuben Carter, but perhaps his favorite song to play on guitar was Sunshine, which almost always ended with him on his feet singing at the top of his daily regenerated lungs by the last lines of the chorus. He can't even run his own life. I'll be damned if he'll run mine. School was the primary reason for Bert's disappearances, but he also just up and walked out of the house, often in the later afternoon or early evening. It didn't take long for me to figure out that when he walked out, he was just going as far as the salt shed. In some cases, he would get up and go to the phone on the wall in the kitchen, dial, and then talk in low tones. If Velma was present, he might give her a slight signal indicating he was going out to smoke. He would slip out the door and walk down the driveway and disappear behind the salt shed. Usually, when he made a call, a truck from the town public works department would appear a few minutes later and park in front of the shed. My own activities that summer centered around that bookcase. Almost every morning I would stay in my room exploring those books until I heard the sounds of other people in the house stirring. At first I sought out picture books and books where I could spot photo plates, those sections of thicker, glossy paper devoted to photographs. One of my first discoveries was a picture Bible with a gift plate inside the cover with to and from, and lines that were filled in with the shapely cursive hand Chrissy and Aunt Peggy, respectively. There were English and reading books stamped Canaan Public School System inside the front cover with large threes on them, a couple with fours. There were music books and books about music, and then there were many, many books that would remain mysteries to me that summer, dense pages full of text and small print. I could make out a good number of words, a, an, the, with, for, from, first, second, third, six, seven, left, people, state, party, war, labor, class, but I seldom had the patience to stick with any of those books long enough to get through more than a page or two. I started with whatever seemed to yield to me most readily. This became my normal, reading about Red Dog, Blue Cat, deciphering the need to liberate women, and absorbing critiques of the 25 top rock and roll albums from the first 25 years of rock and roll. This little stock of books, stacked along the wall of Bert and Velma's junk room, became my anchor. Over the course of the summer, Chrissy also taught me other rounds to sing, involving London, France, Underpants, Mary Mac Mac Mac, Sailors Going to CCC, and Absurd Fantastical Creatures. Chrissy always left me laughing. Nothing bothered me as long as I peered into the pages of those books or Chrissy's calming smile. Food was also an adventure that summer. I could count on one hand the number of times we had a sit-down meal. Salad or vegetable, potatoes or beans, pasta or casserole. More often than that, we just had boxed cereal or homemade brownies or granola bars baked with some mixture of nuts, chocolate chips, grains, and things that I didn't know you could bake into granola, like dried kale and oregano. The first time we had brownies, Chrissy brought a plate over to me on the sofa and watched me intently as I ate first one, then two, and then a third, at which point she said, "That's enough. You'll get sick if you eat any more." The crowning event of each week would be a phone call from my mother, usually Sunday evenings. She would talk to Velma. Velma would then call me into the kitchen and hand the phone receiver to me, saying, "Nelson, it's Mommy." I would hear the voice on the line seemingly growing dimmer each successive week, certainly growing less familiar, more distant. As the weeks passed, it seemed what was said became more urgent, more desperate, while the caller became less real. Everyone has those early memories fade, walking hand in hand in the garden, playing peekaboo. "Nelson, where are you?" "Here I am." But this was like being expelled from the garden, never to return. Overall, the summer just seemed strange, strained. Those who made the most of living a principled hippie existence seemed most out of sync with their general approach to life. Love yourself, love the world, be free. They said you should free yourself of rules imposed by other people, but they seemed to just replace them by imposing rules themselves. And nothing was necessarily wrong with their rules, they just seemed arbitrary. Make love, not war. Be an individual. Reject conformity, especially conformity to government rules, social norms, or mainstream society. Avoid violence. Love nature, animals, and plants. Talk to them. Express yourself, especially through music or art. Freedom, freedom, freedom. Freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of love, freedom to be yourself. And most of all, love yourself first, and everything else that really matters would fall into place. Among all of these new non-rules, Jesus was strangely thrown on top like a hood ornament. Jesus Christ Superstar. It was a non-threatening, no-authority Jesus. See, Jesus opposed the government. Jesus is my friend. Jesus is just all right. And most reliably, whenever anything did not go as planned, his name was called on vociferously. By the end of July, things were becoming familiar, routine. As I sat on the sofa thumbing through Playboy, Velma stuck her head out of the kitchen. "Do you know the word obscure?" I looked up and answered, "OBSCURE, to hide." She smiled. We heard the sound of Bert's slow footsteps on the porch floor, and then he entered through the front door. His eyes were red. I turned the page and began to read what I found on the next spread, The Bog Man by Margaret Atwood. I could make out most of the words. Bert came over, standing behind the sofa, looking over my shoulder. "He's reading," he blurted. "He is actually reading the articles. Jeez, get this kid some more books." He giggled and wandered into the kitchen. I heard the refrigerator door. By now, I had grown comfortable venturing farther and farther out from the house, at least where I could still see the house. I found several pine trees that I was able to climb, offering plentiful limbs starting close to the ground, allowing me to climb up as much as 8 or 10 feet. From one tree or another, this was enough to give me a full view of the back of the salt shed, the full run of the stream as it flowed from the pond and down through the side yard. I could follow Bert's ritual visits to the far side of the shed. I could follow Velma through her paths of grief. Chrissy would flit in and out of my view, the least predictable one in the house. Then one afternoon, I noticed her heading across the living room and out the front door, where she disappeared onto the porch. But then she reappeared on the far side of the house, following the stream. Curious, I descended from my perch and headed around the far side of the house to follow. As I stood a stone's throw from the pond, Chrissy slipped off her sandals and drew down her jeans, revealing her panties and lifting her shirt over her head and dropping it on top of her sandals. She walked slowly into the pond until the water approached her shoulders. She ducked her head under the water and reemerged, tossing her hair back. Then, turning around, she saw me standing there. She laughed. "Nelson, are you watching me? Where are you going?" "Right here, you silly." She smiled, slowly moving her arms back and forth just under the water's surface. There's nothing better than a cool dip on a hot day. She continued, smiling at me. You want to come in and cool off? Leave your clothes on the grass. You probably want to keep your underwear on. She bobbed gently in the water.
You don't want any little fishies nibbling your nuggets.
I approached the pond, stopping where Chrissy had left her clothes, and I removed all but my underwear. The grass felt cool under my bare feet. I started toward the edge of the pond. As I neared the edge, I recoiled as the muddy bank squished a little between my toes. The scent of the warm air changed from the fainter, drier, sweet and bitter fragrances of grasses, daisies, goldenrod, to surprisingly strong floral and musky scents wafting from blossoming milkweed and plants at the water's edge.
After pausing momentarily,
I continued into the water. My toes felt the smooth stones and water weeds on the bottom of the pond. I could see small fish within an arm's length, probably as curious as I was.
As I edged in until the water reached my chest, Chrissy moved toward me, offering a hand. She emerged up to her waist.
After what I'd been exposed to over the last 6 weeks, this was nothing out of the ordinary. I reached out my hand and met hers, steadying me in the water. Another step, and the water was up to my chest. Now just bend down, she said. I obeyed. I leaned forward and then began to float with my feet intermittently touching the bottom. I opened my eyes to a strange world of muted sound and vibrant greens and blues where sight lines seemed to follow different laws, and Chrissy stood before me, as only legs and torso, cut off at the midriff. The surface of the water above me became a mirror, reflecting the green water ferns and pond weeds as if they could be hanging from a ceiling, while at the same time showing off a faint off-kilter image of the world above. As I moved my head up and down, the two competing views of the realm above traded off, one growing clearer as the other grew fainter. I raised back up and returned to the world I knew, with swallows and blue jays pridefully commanding the limitless skies. I turned to walk out of the pond, realizing just now how hot the day had become, yet feeling my core cooled and refreshed. I walked out in slow motion, moving from the smooth weeds and rocks onto the squishy, inclined mud floor, and then once again onto the grass, returning to my native world. Behind me I could hear Chrissy sloshing through the water on her own passage out. I began to dress immediately. Chrissy said, "You may want to wait a minute to let the sun dry you off." I was already dressed, and my outer clothes were soaked through from the inside, sticking to my skin. I looked back at Chrissy, who was now reaching down to pick up her things. As she stood up, a Canaan Public Works truck came by, slowing down as the occupants spotted us, the two occupants swiveling their heads to look, and then they sped up, no doubt continuing on to the salt shed. The dog days of August had begun when Velma got a call from my mother. With less than a month left to serve at the country club,
my father had suffered a massive heart attack. The doctors at the club had tried to save him.
Velma held me like a vice. She said, "I'm so sorry, Nellie. I'm so sorry." She smelled of dandelion and mint and lilac. Nothing about this seemed real. I do remember some hours later, sitting with Bert on the steps of the front porch. "Sorry about your dad, kid." He sounded more official than sincere. He broke a brownie in two, offering me a half. "But you know, he kind of had it coming."
"You can't cheat karma."
I shook off the offer of the brownie. I looked up at him and spoke without thinking. "If you can't cheat karma, then why are you so angry all the time?" I could feel my jaw clenching. "Karma is not my religion, little man."
"But you believe in karma."
"No." He shook his head vaguely.
"So if you don't believe in karma, then why can't you cheat karma?"
I wasn't sure where this was going, but it was just coming out, and it was getting under his skin. He looked at me, narrowing his eyes. "I know you're hurting right now, figuring out how to process what just happened. It's natural." I stared at him hotly, focusing all my anger on him, and I said the one thing I had been keeping in reserve the whole summer. "My father says teachers will never get paid decent money as long as schools treat teachers and kids like cattle. If you're not a cow, don't act like one." Bert looked at me again and then looked off into the distance. "That makes absolutely no sense." He seemed to smile to himself. He looked down at me. "First of all, correction. Said. Your father doesn't say anything anymore. Secondly, your father was an ass. A big ass with a little brown hole in the middle and lots of hair around the edges." He seemed to stifle a laugh. "And third, what does that mean? Are you going to let students and teachers act like capitalists
just find each other. Let teachers decide which students they want to teach and let students decide which teachers they want to learn from. That's just chaos. That would never amount to anything.
Isn't that what Jesus did? He said, come with me and I'll teach you how to fish.
Yeah, and look what it got him. He got the shaft from the man big time. I remember running up the stairs, blindly bawling, throwing myself down on my mattress. My father was supposed to come back in another month, and now he's not coming back at all. My mother has been reduced to a voice fading on the other end of a phone line, and I'm stuck in a world where rules are like pond weeds, and Jesus is just all right, and love is cheaper than white bread. The next week was the build-up to August 10th. Bert would have a party, and then Bert would have 2 weeks free from hassle to relax and recover before the regular school year would start. He had invited two other teachers, Jeremy and Fiona, who had worked summer school with him. He was also inviting two friends who worked for the town, Rod and Des. There was talk of Fiona bringing a boyfriend. When the day arrived, Bert came home mid-afternoon, as usual, and began fussing about chairs and coolers, corn cobs, beans, firewood, and skewers, and all the details of setting up for his party. I found a place to lay low and stay out of Bert's way. The smell of cooking food brought me out of hiding as the sun was setting. I approached the adults who were crowded around the fire pit, sitting, drinking, and eating. A folding card table was set up between the house and the fire. I edged toward a plate of hot dogs and stood at the table, eating. Noticing me, Bert got up from his seat and walked into the backyard with his hand-rolled cigarette. Two others followed him. I moved into one of the vacated seats. As the three passed one cigarette, Chrissy joined the small circle, handling it as it passed. Bert returned around the side of the house to the fire pit. From where I now sat, I could see the three in the backyard. Des seemed to be leaning into Chrissy, his hand lingering as she passed the cigarette to him. I could see she was backing away from him slightly with each pass. She moved to return to the fire pit. Des reached out as if to stop her, but she turned and started walking back. Des followed back toward the fire. He dropped off his empty beer bottle and then picked up two bottles from the open cooler, leaning over to use the opener that was tied to the cooler handle by a piece of twine.
He took a sip from one open bottle and walked the other over to where Chrissy now stood, staring into the fire,
looking red-eyed. Des held the bottle out in front of her. She saw that he blocked her path to the front of the house. She backed away and began walking toward the backyard. Des moved to follow. Walking became running. Chrissy, barefoot, sprinted around the back of the house. Bert, noticing the sudden activity, got up from his seat beside the fire and started walking slowly around the back of the house. Hey! Des broke into a trot as Chrissy bolted like a fleeing deer. I could see Chrissy rise as she attempted to clear the stream, flitting first to one stone and then to a second. But her second landing skated, her legs flying out from under her, her head and feet trading places in one sudden motion, ending with a splash. Chrissy didn't move.
The adults began to gather around her still body.
Bert walked over, holding out his hands as if to calm the situation.
Hold on. What's the fuss?
Jeremy, with his thick red sideburns, walked slowly over. Fiona walked over with a little more urgency. Velma, turning in her chair by the fire, realizing who was involved, jumped up and ran over. Seeing the situation, she began to shout, "Call an ambulance! Someone call an ambulance!" "We don't need any ambulance!" Bert shouted her down. "No need to call anyone!"
Chrissy was lying unresponsive in the stream, red billows spreading downstream.
Jeremy grabbed Chrissy's body under the arms and pulled her onto the grassy bank. He stood back as Velma kneeled down to tend to her daughter. Realizing at first touch that something was very wrong, Velma now shouted, "Call an ambulance! Someone call an ambulance!" Chrissy responded to neither touch nor sound. Velma's shouts devolved into sobs. While chaos ran wild in the backyard, I had run into the house, seeking out the wall phone in the kitchen. I pulled out the Litchfield County, Connecticut phone book from the stand below the phone. I pulled a kitchen chair over to the wall, climbed up, took down the receiver, and dialed the number on the cover of the phone book that followed "Emergency." It rang. "Yes, we need an ambulance. At the salt shed on Depot Road." The voice in the handset asked, "Can I get a name? Can I get a name?" I hung up. Outside, Bert stood over Velma as she cradled Chrissy's body. "Everything's under control." His voice was losing authority as the reality sank in. "We don't need..." He still held out his arms as if commanding the situation. Meanwhile, Des and Rod had disappeared. Fiona and her boyfriend were collecting their things and heading toward their car. Jeremy, seemingly weighing his options, signaled to Bert that he was bailing too. I made my way back to the scene. Velma continued to cry and plead for someone to call for an ambulance. I stood on the opposite bank, perhaps 6 feet away. I called. Velma looked up at me with an unrecognizable face. Bert looked at me with a mixture of hatred and resignation. Epilogue. Police and ambulance arrived in a matter of minutes. I ran upstairs and hid in one of the storage spaces behind the hanging rack in the junk room. Bert and Velma were arrested and booked by Canaan police. 3 months later, they were convicted of possession of a controlled substance. They were also charged with negligence in connection with Chrissy's death. On that charge, they were acquitted in court, but found guilty in the court of public opinion. The Canaan and Sharon school systems dismissed them both unceremoniously from their teaching jobs, even before their cases went to trial. A quick divorce followed. Velma moved to Florida, where she found work as a teacher without anyone knowing her story. Bert stayed put and found work in a package store. He seemed to find perverse pleasure in the local notoriety. My mother passed the first week of January, just weeks before Velma left for Florida. 6 years later, Velma was diagnosed with the same type of liver cancer that took my mother. She died 11 months later. After I heard the ambulance and police car pull away from the house, I emerged from the storage space. I went downstairs and found a box of Cap'n Crunch on the kitchen counter. I sat on the sofa and shoveled cereal into my mouth until I fell asleep, with one arm clutching the box to my chest and the other still inside the box up to the elbow. The next day, the Canaan police returned to the house and brought me and my suitcase into the station. They called my mother. 2 hours later, my sister, looking suddenly adult, arrived. My mother waited in the car. She looked and sounded like my grandmother. I don't know what happened to Bert, and I don't care. 16 years later, I finished a degree in divinity at Yale, and I've been working for 14 years as an army chaplain at Fort Devens. But my father had the last word when a lawyer contacted me and Patty and informed us that the house on Depot Road belonged to a trust that should have been put in our names when our parents died, which brings me back to the house, to do with as we wish. I continued past the salt shed onto the dirt driveway and up to the front porch. The door was unlocked. Knocking loudly on the open door, I listened for any answer or telltale sounds of squatting raccoons or dragons. Silence. The house looked so much smaller than I remembered it. I continued across the living room and up the stairs. I paused in the upstairs hallway to run my hand across what remained of the beads in Chrissy's doorway. I turned back to the junk room. Walking past the empty clothes rack, I crouched down and opened the storage space door. I picked up the children's picture Bible that sat there on the floor where I had left it. I went back down the stairs, through the kitchen, and out the back door to the stream that still runs along the side of the house. Finding a stepping stone that might have marked where Chrissy's story ended, I placed the Bible on the stone, bowed my head, and made the sign of hope.
Thanks, Doug, for allowing us to read that poignant story. Well, that's the end of the episode. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Please join us next week when our guest author will be Chaya Bhuvaneshwar. The music you hear at the beginning of each episode is by C.S. Fuqua, and the closing music is by Matt Hawkins. You can find out more about their music from a link on our homepage at shortstorytoday.com. You've been listening to Short Story Today, where we celebrate short stories and the authors who write them.
Across the bridge of stories are tomboy.